History of Middle Ages, the 15th talk in a series titled History of Christian Thought, was presented by David Crabtree on February 1, 1988, from McKinsey Study Center School of Exegesis. McKinsey Study Center is now an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2013. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side. The following recording was made in a classroom setting, and many of the students' questions were inaudible. It is hoped that Dr. Crabtree's answers will be sufficient to understand the context.
I'll go through this very quickly, and I'm sure that I'll end up skipping large sections. But my point in doing this at all is to try to give you some idea of the political events that were taking place and which brought about the changes that we see in doctrine and theology. The Reformation didn't spring out of nowhere. There is a reason why it came about when it came about. And I hope that by presenting this material you'll have a better idea of why the reaction was the way it was in the Reformation. The Middle Ages is sometimes called the Dark Ages, and the reason is because of the darkness that fell over Europe, both intellectual as well as social darkness. Western Europe had virtually all been controlled by the Romans at one point in time. And I used to think that the Roman control in Europe was fairly nominal. But having studied a little bit more, I'm convinced that that was not the case. Western Europe was significantly changed by its exposure to Roman culture. There was a great deal of urban growth. And Latins, people from Rome, were moved into those urban cities. And the indigenous population was Germanic, and they were very much attracted to the Roman culture. So although Latin did not become the dominant language in Europe, people were generally aware of it, and they were aware of Latin culture and attracted to it. And they absorbed it to a fairly significant degree. So if there is an heir in the West to the Roman civilization, it's Western Europe. The Roman Empire was declining in the, what would it be, 5th century. In 395, it was divided east and west, and that division was never healed after that. There was a time when the empire from the east was able to reconquer part of Italy, but the empire was never really successfully rejoined. In the west, it disintegrated rather rapidly. The main problem was a group of Huns, who were Asiatic peoples moving from the steppes in Asia, were moving west, and they were pushing the Germanic tribes away in front of them. Most of Western Europe was inhabited by Germanic peoples, and they were the ones who were controlled by Rome. Just beyond the borders were their relatives, who were also Germanic peoples. So, for instance, the Goths. Many of them were part of the Roman Empire and fought with the Roman armies. In fact, they were the mainstay of the Roman armies in the West. Most of the soldiers in the Roman army at the time, the 5th century, were Germans. They were not Latins. By far and away, the majority. they're coming from the steppes of Russia, moving. Well, I don't know where they originated, but they started in this. They're at this time they're in the steppes and they're moving west, and they're pushing all the peoples in front of them. The Huns going this way with Attila, his quarterback. They're pushing this way, and we've got the Goths here defending, and they decide, we don't want to go that way, we're going to go this way. And this is the Roman Empire. They decide that they would rather take on the Roman army at this point in time than the Huns.
Weren't the Goths, didn't you just say that the Roman army was made up of Goths?
Mm-hmm.
And the Goths were taking on the Goths.
That's right.
Yeah. That too.
These were Germanic peoples. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That were inhabiting Western Europe and Eastern Europe at this time. The ones, many of them had become part of the Roman Empire and were incorporated into it. And the majority of the army in the West, the Roman army, was made up of Germanic peoples, many of them Goths. But the ones just outside the border were relatives of those people that were in the Roman army. They were also Goths. And they said, some of them said, here come the Huns, we would rather come over here and fight for the Romans, and they became Romans, part of the Roman army. And others said, we would rather carve out some territory inside the Roman Empire than stay here and be clobbered by the Huns. So either way, they went west, either as a friend of Rome or in order to carve out some territory for themselves. As Rome became weaker and weaker, more and more of this was carved out, Rome being in Italy, down here, the center of Rome, of the Roman Empire in the west. More and more areas were carved out, and eventually we had the Visigoths who tried to go down to Constantinople, were turned back, and ended up coming down and sacking Rome. And so eventually the Germanic peoples destroyed the western part of the empire. Now, a curious fact is that those Goths were Christian, but they were Arian. Remember during the time of the Christological controversy, there was a period of time when Arianism was predominant. This was after the Nicene Council, it was between the two councils. Arianism was predominant. During that time, even though it lost out at the Nicene Council, it became predominant soon thereafter for political reasons. They sent out missionaries to the north to evangelize the Goths, and they did. But they converted them to Arian Christianity, Arianism. So when they came down and took over, they basically tried to imitate Roman customs. But they were Arians. And as far as the people in Rome were concerned, they were heretics. There were other peoples that were on the move at the same time. Do I have them listed here? There are Franks, which are Germanic. They're moving in. That's some of the Germans that are moving into this area. We'll talk about the Muslims later. During this time, then, the Goths had taken over Italy and were ruling over Italy. And then later the Lombards came in and controlled it. They also were a Germanic tribe. The Lombards came back down from the north. So here we have the Roman Latin population, which is Catholic Christian, being controlled by Gothic Arians, Germanic Arians. They didn't like them. There was a power that grew up in Gaul, the Franks, which had been converted to Catholicism. The Pope, being surrounded by Arians and being afraid of them, decided that he would throw his support behind the king there, and that's Clovis. He was the first king of the Gauls, worthy of note. And we're going to begin to see this pattern where whenever the Pope is threatened by the peoples around him, he is going to ask for the help of some king up in Northern Europe to help him. That's what he does in this case. Eventually, the power of the Gauls increases under the Carolingian dynasty. We have Pepin, and then Charles Martel, who's the one who beat off the Muslims in France, and then Pepin the Short, who was eventually crowned by the Pope as the King of France. Now, to bring us up to date on that, when we get to the time of Charles Martel, who beat off the Muslims, gotta expand this. My map isn't real accurate here. Another group that was on the move were the Muslims, who had formed under Muhammad. He was the founding prophet of the religion. And it was a very short time before the Muslims had built themselves into a significant military force. They moved out from where they were. They couldn't go. They were here in Syria and that area. They couldn't go north through Turkey because the Eastern Roman Empire was still strong at the time, based in Byzantium. They couldn't go that way. So they went through North Africa, all the way across, until they got just south of Spain, and then went up through Spain. They conquered all of Spain and started to move into France. And that's where they were beaten by Charles Martel. And they were pushed back across the Pyrenees. Those are the Pyrenees. But they continued to occupy Spain. Now, this becomes significant later on. The Muslims developed quite a group of scholars. And much of their material that they worked from, the body of knowledge that they built upon, was the Greek philosophers. And one of the major figures, one of the major thinkers that they drew upon was Aristotle. In the western half of the empire, under the influence of Christianity, Plato's thinking had been, to a certain degree, preserved. But Aristotelian thinking had not been preserved. In the Muslim world, Aristotelian thinking was more important. As a result, when they came and lived in Spain, they had with them a large body of writings about Aristotle. And Aristotle's own writings. And as we'll see, that becomes a significant input into the theological thinking in the Middle Ages. That re-exposure to Aristotelian thinking. Well, they made it up into France, but were beaten back, so they weren't in France very long. But they were in Spain for quite a while. Okay, Pepin the Short he was crowned King of France by the Pope. So he became the officially recognized ruler in Europe, authenticated by the Pope. Later, Charlemagne, his son, was crowned Emperor of the Romans by Pope Leo III. Now, these kings wanted to pattern themselves after the Roman rulers. They wanted to see themselves as ruling over a reborn Roman culture. Charlemagne learned Greek and Latin. I have seen in textbooks, some of them say that he knew it very well and talk about how well he knew it, and others say that he knew it only superficially. But the fact that he wanted to learn it at all, and that he encouraged that kind of study in his kingdom is interesting. His son, Louis the Pious, was more pious than he was a good king. He lost a great deal of the power. And then he split the kingdom between his three sons. Well, he didn't actually split it between the three sons. His sons split the kingdom between his three sons. Basically, in in strips, kind of filleted. Those are the lines they drew. What is it, Louis in the east? Lothar in the central strip, including Italy, and then Lord Charles the Bald in Western Europe. But Saxony and Bavaria are in the one farthest to the east. Lombardy and part of Austrasia are in the central one. And Neustria, sounds like a little varmint, and Aquitaine are in the one in the west. Okay, then comes the second barrage of plunderers and pillagers. It's all very decentralized. The Germanic style was to have a ruler would rise up with the help of his buddies and would control an area, and they would swear their loyalty to that leader. On his death, he would divide it up between his sons. So it's continually getting further and further fragmented. And then you'll have someone rising up who is able to take over one of the weaker sons. Let me show you. Here we've got Germany. And we've got King A, B, C, and D. D dies and leaves it to E, his four sons, E, F, G, and H. And C dies and leaves it to I, J, K, and L. Now, so it's getting further and further fragmented. Then you have to have the second. Then what will happen is one of these will become stronger and he'll take over K. But when he dies, he splits it up. So the whole process is basically fragmenting. There are two things that are happening. One is the Romans, towards the end of the empire, they began to tax Europe extremely heavily. So the wealthy people in the cities said, "I'm no dummy. Taxes are collected in the cities. I'm leaving. I'm going to go out into the countryside where I will not be taxed. And I will set up my own little farm there and avoid the tax man." So the cities were abandoned. The economy broke down. The cities were abandoned because it was too heavily taxed. So then we've got these rich people living in their own little villas scattered around, but city life has died out. And with the social chaos created by the invasions, it made it even more fragmented. Well, then the question was, how do we protect ourselves? Roman rule has fallen apart completely. Here we are out in our little villas. How do we protect ourselves? Well, what we have to do is we have to hire soldiers to protect us. How do we support those soldiers? Well, we'll get peasants to farm. We'll get peasants to farm for them in exchange for their protection as well. And that's basically the way the feudal system developed. So Europe is basically in chaos. There's very little rule. There's very little order. And it's only in small areas that you've got any amount of law and order. Well, the only one of significance in this time was in France. The Carolingian dynasty was able to establish an island of a certain amount of order here. So the Pope said, that's the only place that I can look to. He's the only Catholic around with any power. All the ones that were around him were Arians, and he didn't trust them. Charlemagne was a king of the Franks. Okay, does that make more sense? The Franks were able to expand into most of this area that I showed you on that map. They didn't have it in wonderful control, but to one degree or another, they had it under control. That does not include Spain. They did not control Spain. but most of Western Europe, to one degree or another, they it didn't include England either. Then came another wave of invasions. The Vikings came down from the north under all kinds of different names. Basically, the Scandinavians came down from the north.
Driving bubbles.
Driving what?
Bubbles and sod.
For the most part, they were just pillagers and plunderers. They would come and wreck havoc and then go home. It's kind of like... I was living in Paris for a year, and Easter vacation was a very strange time in Paris. I swear, you hear more people speaking German on the subways during Easter vacation than you do French. The French either go in hiding or they take off, they leave the city. And the Germans just come down by the busload, and they're everywhere. And they spend their Easter vacation in Paris. And they were obnoxious. It's really incredible.
Kind of like Americans all summer long.
Well, it is. It is. Well, only more concentrated. I think it was because of... Yeah, that's true. The Place Pigalle, which is the red light district. I, by mistake, was going through there one evening in during the Easter week. And it was just obnoxious. So the same kind of thing still happened. The Scandinavians had come down from the north, basically wrecking havoc, destroying things. People were fleeing to feudal estates, any place they could find protection. And this is when feudalism really gets going strong. Monasteries were not sacred to the Vikings. They destroyed everything, including monasteries. Maybe even especially monasteries. And a great deal of literature and stuff was destroyed during this time. Well, that has been debated. Some people say it's population. Some say that their population was too great and that they were going for trying to expand and find new land to settle. It's not clear. I mean, that's the reason that's given. It did kill some people. It did relieve some of the population, probably. When you get rid of a few people, you send them out, say, here's a one-way ticket, go pillage and plunder. But the Norwegians tended to go west, Iceland, Greenland, and they think even made it to America. The Danes, and they also went to Scotland. The Danes went to southern England and then into northern Europe. The Swedes went to Russia. Russia was organized by Vikings, and they went to stay. The Danes tended to go to stay as well. It's the Vikings that were the main plunderers and pillagers. The Vikings were the Norwegians, for the most part, as I understand it. Okay, that's from the north and the south. In the Mediterranean area, the Saracens. They were just pirates. Just plunderers and pillagers. I don't know. I think they were from North Africa, but I don't know what their ancestry is. And then the Hungarians, the Magyars, came through. That was a tribe from the east again. We continually have these groups coming from the east, and it's not clear where, Mongolia or somewhere, just spits out these groups, and they think it's because of population pressure that caused them to move westward. And then when they push through, they push everybody in front of them. And the Hungarians was another one of those. These all tend to be pastoral people. And so they're attracted to areas where they can move their flocks without having to cross mountains or anything like that. And so the natural path is to go west. Well, as far as written and historical record, we have very little on those groups. I don't know, but I'm sure there's a lot of written material from China and say Japan and those cultures. But it's these cultures that are up where what is now Mongolia, that area, is what seems to have spun out all these people that go west. And they were not, I don't know if they were literate, but we don't have writings from them. So the Hungarians first appear, as far as I know, first appear on the historical record in what is now Hungary, or just east of Hungary. They moved into Hungary, controlled it, and attacked Europe from there, but they ended up intermarrying with the people in Hungary, and the result is the modern-day Hungarians. It was the Anogars, that was the tribe from the east. The indigenous population in Hungary were the Magyars. They intermarried and settled down, and the Magyars, that combination of the Anogars and the Magyars, is now what Hungary is populated with. And just for your information, this is bizarre, strange but true, Hungarian is related to Finnish, and they are unrelated to the Indo-European languages. There's also a Turkish language that's related to them. There are three languages, Finnish, Hungarian, and some Turkish language that are all related, and they are, as far as they can tell, they are unrelated to any other known languages.
Well, the letters are just like ours, but
really?
You've always got piled up two or three of the same vowel together and stuff like that. They've got, just to help you in your Greek, they have 14 cases in their language. So you can be thankful that the Bible wasn't written in Finnish.
The Hungarians?
Yeah.
Well, they tried to move west, but they were thwarted in moving farther west than Hungary, basically Hungary. And that's where they intermarried with the population that was already there, and they ended up
settling and staying.
No, they weren't Germanic. I don't think they were Germanic. They were the Magyars. That's that group that was related to the Finns and that one.
I will say very little about England, except that
there was a king that rose up in England called Alfred the Great. He established a little kingdom there that was constantly bombarded by Danes coming down. He was successful against them and to one degree or another. Then when he died, his son took over. His son was not successful. That's somebody, the unready. And then it was taken over by the Danes. And the Danes controlled it for quite a while and actually made conditions better there, unified England to a certain degree, and English culture was able to continue and thrive. And was not Danified, Danished, whatever happens when Danes move in. One group of Vikings that came down, they struck up a deal with the king of Western Europe, whoever that was in the western part, and in France. He gave them a section of territory to settle in. Being rather smart, he decided, I'll settle them on the coast where they can fight the next batch of Vikings coming down. And those are the Normans. And the Normans pop up a number of times in this history. The king of the Normans later on was William, and he was related to the ruler in England when there was dynastic trouble. And he decided that he would go settle the dynastic problems by becoming king himself. So he went across and took over England.
So that was the Norman invasion, the Norman conquest. That was William the Conqueror who did that. Germany. France, after the Carolingian dynasty, France basically fell apart. And in Germany, we have the next significant kingdom rising. Otto the First established a base of power, and the Pope appealed to him to get the Lombards off his back. And so he had him come down, and Otto said, I'll come down if you will crown me the Holy Roman Emperor. And the Pope said, sure. So he went down and took care of the Lombards for the Pope and gave him a piece of land. I think he's the one that gave him a piece of land called the Papal States. After Otto the First, we have Otto.
At this time, the Pope had very little power, I mean, compared to later times, he had very little power. Basically, he begged Otto to come down and get the Lombards off his back. Otto the First did so under the condition that he be made Holy Roman Emperor. So he ends up controlling Germany and a great deal of what is now Italy. That area, you can tell by the line where it goes. And then he began to make ecclesiastical appointments. He called the shots, basically. He said, I want this person to be a bishop here and this person to be a bishop here.
You talking about Otto?
Otto and his successors. So he was calling the shots during this period of time. And that becomes a tradition that the Pope is less and less enthused about as time goes on. In Italy, the area is controlled by the Lombard dukes. It was split up into little city-states controlled by various Lombard dukes, and they would duke it out and trade control and all that sort of thing. And the bishops decided, well, they've got a good thing. Why can't we kind of get in on this? And so the bishops kicked the dukes out, and the bishops replaced them and did the same thing. They go there. Here's where you get the warrior bishop who leads his army into battle against another Lombard state in order to gain control of it. So, obviously not a case of separation of church and state.
Are these bishops appointed by Otto or someone else?
Well, at this, in Lombardy, Otto's control is not very good. And so the bishops are generally appointed through local political maneuvering. Okay, now we move into another period of time, which is called the beginning of the High Middle Ages, from 1000 to 1300. About this time, Spain was able to break the control of the Moors and send them back to North Africa. And we have two kingdoms arising in Spain, Castile and Barcelona. That's in northern Spain. In southern Spain, it takes longer to get the Moors out. In southern Italy, this is kind of a funny episode. The Pope was concerned again about the Lombard princes. It was called the Lombard League. German control here had broken down. So the Pope had a good idea. There were some unemployed Normans up here in Normandy, so he decided to hire them to come down and establish. Basically, they were poor, out of jobs, and you know that when people are poor and out of jobs, the crime rate goes up. Well, they decided to go down to southern Italy and raise the crime rate, took over the area. The Pope said, come on up to Rome and get rid of the Lombards around me. They came down and were successful in southern Italy. And so the Pope said, come on up and take care of these Lombards around me. And they did.
But did he invite them to southern Italy?
Or no.
They went there on their
own.
No,
I think that they were just looking for warmer climates. They got a little overzealous, however, and sacked Rome in the process. Pope wasn't too happy about it. But eventually they were pushed out, but they continued to control southern Italy for quite a while. About this time, we have the Crusades starting. Here's the situation. The Muslims controlled the Palestine, but pious pilgrims from Europe wanted to go and see the holy sites. And we're doing so regularly. But there was a period of time when the pilgrims began to be harassed by the Muslims. Either they'd be robbed or something, one or another thing would happen. Word got back to the Pope about all these incidents that were occurring, and he said, and his idea was, let's stop fighting among ourselves. We should send our best fighting men to Palestine and free it from Muslim control. Good idea. So he shipped them out. They went to Palestine, where were modestly successful in winning back the strip along the Mediterranean coast, and they divided up into, I think it's four Crusader estates, Crusader kingdoms, and set up their own kingdoms there. Of Europe?
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Well, the Pope wanted to, apparently there were pressures that were on him because of the fighting that was going on in Europe. And in order to divert the problems, he called the crusade to get some of the main players out of Europe and get them someplace else where they could do their damage. And it was moderately successful in doing that for a period of time. But eventually the Muslims, well, in the Second Crusade, I think what happened to spark the Second Crusade was that the Muslims regained control of one of those Crusader kingdoms. But as time goes on, the Crusades get more and more, what's the word, there's less and less discipline in them, and they become more and more just like raiding parties, and more bizarre. There's one of them, I don't remember which one it is, there was one of them where the Crusaders went down to Venice to take off, but they didn't have enough money to pay for their passage on ships, and they wanted to go by ship, they didn't want to buy over land. Well, some Byzantine merchants said, if you will come and capture a port that was controlled by the King of Hungary at that time, if you will come and control and capture that port, then we'll just take you for free. So they said, sure, we'll do that. The Pope, meanwhile, said, don't do that. He's a Catholic. The King of Hungary's a Catholic, so don't do that. Well, the Crusaders went and sacked the city anyway. The Pope excommunicated them because they had done it. Then they went to Byzantium. And when they arrived at Byzantium, there was a pretender to the throne of the Emperor of Byzantium. He was the legitimate heir to the throne in Byzantium, and someone else was sitting on the throne. And so this pretender to the throne asked the Crusaders, come and help me. They said, sure. So they sacked Byzantium, which is kind of ironic because something that the Muslims were unable to do on several attempts, we have Crusaders from the West coming on a raiding mission and just kind of a lark, and they come in and sack Byzantium, which did not do wonderful things for relations between East and West. However, after they sacked Byzantium, they put a Catholic in the seat of the Patriarch of Byzantium, and the Pope, what do you do when you take away the excommunication? He reinstated the Crusaders back into the faith. There's another one of the Crusades that was particularly bizarre. It was called the Children's Crusade, and I think this was started by a monk. I don't think this was started by a pope. But anyway, he told all the children to come down to some place in southern Italy, and when they got there and gathered there, God would part the sea, the Mediterranean Sea, and they would be able to walk to Palestine on dry land. And then miraculously, they would overcome the Muslims and all that sort of thing. Well, children came down from all over Europe to southern Italy. They didn't even get a decent low tide. And so some of the kids went back home, but a lot of them were sold into slavery to the Muslims by Normans. Normans in search of money. At this time, the church has become quite corrupt. And if you want to read about corruption in the Church of the Middle Ages, the third volume in the Pelican series, and this is, I mean, the Pelican as in, no, Penguin. The third volume in the Penguin book series. That is confusing. Just two birds. It's called Society in the Middle Ages, I think, and it's by Southern. And he talks a great deal about the situation in the church at that time. And it's rather interesting. Monasteries and bishoprics were run virtually like kingdoms. Bishops would establish control. They would use political means to get things done. They'd buy their position as a bishop often. They would use political means to get rid of other bishops so they could expand control and that sort of thing. They'd have people assassinated and that sort of thing. They would, when they died, they would pass their bishopric on to their children, which seems strange on a number of counts. One, they were supposed to be celibate, but they often had concubines, women that they lived with and had children by, and they wanted to pass on their estates to their heirs, just like a king would, and that's what they did. The whole church was rife with corruption. So at this time, there was a movement for reform, and there were basically two camps that were pushing for reform. One camp said, what we need to do is just get strict on the rules. The basic setup, the basic structure is fine. We just need to enforce the rules and get rid of the bad eggs. The other camp said, no, the problem is secular control. The problem is the fact that there are secular kings who have too much to say, secular rulers who have too much to say in how the church is run. If we could get all of the control out of their hands, then the church would be fine. We'd be able to do wonderful things. So basically, the way they envisioned Europe was an area in which the supreme power in the whole continent was the Pope, with the king subservient to them. In 1032, a fellow became Pope by buying the position, Benedict the Ninth. He was extremely corrupt, immoral. He decided to sell his position, which he did, but then decided he wanted it back, which created a fiasco of greater proportions than the Iran-Contra hearings. And the result was that King Henry III deposed all of the popes and installed a new pope, who was Hildebrand, a monk, and he became Pope Gregory VII. It is during the time of this pope that we have the investiture conflict. The investiture conflict, it was over whether the king is the one who appoints bishops or whether it should be the church. Hildebrand said the church should give them the symbols of their office and not the king. Traditionally, however, the king had given them the symbols of the office. The king at that time, and I think it was Henry IV, but I'm not sure. The king at that time said, I'm not going to do it. And the pope said, then you are excommunicated. You're out of the church. And it worked. Having been excommunicated, a number of those people who were under his authority refused to obey him. And it got to the place where he had no alternative but to go back and ask forgiveness from the Pope, which he did by crawling in the snow, wearing sackcloth, and at Canossa. That was how it was, Canossa.
And apparently, we had 4 days before he got
in. My goodness. What happened to hospitality?
Who was Henry III king? Where was he king?
In Germany. Gregory was of the second camp. He believed that the problem in the church was that there was any secular control over the church at all. Now, Henry III probably didn't realize that when he appointed him. Everyone was pushing for reform. He knew Hildebrand was a reformer. Whether he knew what kind of reform Hildebrand would push for, I don't know. I suspect not. We have a number of situations here where there are power struggles between popes and kings. And the pattern that develops is a pope, when he gains a certain amount of power, will try to use that power to gain more control over the secular king. And the kings, whenever they are feeling particularly powerful, they will try to recapture some strength from something back from the church. And it's a tug of war that continues for quite a while. The papacy reaches its height during Innocent III. That's the papacy is at its very strongest. And after that, the strength of the papacy goes down, but the rhetoric of the papacy is on the increase. When you get to where I have the Unum Sanctum, or however that's pronounced, I don't remember what the fellow's number was. There's like Pope Boniface the 7th, I think. The Unum Sanctum was that every living creature, I think every living creature is supposed to recognize the authority of the Pope in Rome. And they even took this and put it on the altar of Santa Sophia in Byzantium, in Constantinople, which didn't do, that's basically pretty much severs the ties. It isn't until the 1400s that the official break between the Orthodox Church and the Catholic Church occurs, but here in about whatever this date is, I don't remember what it is, it's about 1100 or something, things are pretty well terminated. But Boniface at that time begins making all kinds of outrageous claims for the papacy, and in doing so he incurs the wrath of the King of France at that time. King of France decided that he would not put up with it anymore. He went down to Rome, kidnapped the Pope, but was beaten off by the inhabitants of Rome. And the Pope was so aghast at the treatment that he had been subjected to that he died. But that is the time when we have the height of the rhetoric of the papacy. Boniface was making all kinds of claims for the papacy. Very unrealistic. So it was after that that the papacy was moved to Avignon in France and was very much under the control of the King of France. And it wasn't until later that basically the people in Avignon were sick of having the Pope in France. They had their taxes were increased and everything, so everyone was glad and basically urged the Pope to move back to Rome, which he did in 1376. But then there develops a situation where there are three different people making claims to being the Pope. And it is chaotic and silly before all of the world. And that situation is resolved at the Council of Constance, in which all three of the people who claim to be Pope are removed and a new one is appointed by the bishops. And that event, when there were three people all claiming to be the rightful Pope, and that continued for quite a period of time, that is the event that the reformers look back at and they say, wait a minute, something's wrong here. That if what the church has been claiming all along is that there is this succession of people from the Apostle Peter who are the heirs to Peter's position. And then we have this fiasco where there are three people all claiming to be the heirs of Peter at the same time. and acting in less than a Christian manner.
Do you have any idea what they have?
There are two or three spots in their succession list that it would be very interesting to know what they do with. Well, that's enough. Next time I want to talk about the theological developments in the Middle Ages that precede the Reformation. I want to talk about Scholasticism next time, and then the time after that I want to talk about those people who were forerunners for the Reformation.